It's Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Brian Lynn tells us about a Swiss radio station's recent social experiment. Gregory Stockel and Anna Mateo present this week's Education Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first,
a Swiss radio station recently carried out a social experiment on air, testing robot-created content and voicing. The 13-hour experiment took place on the French language station Couleur 3. During the period, listeners heard the cloned voices of five human presenters. The station's programming also included music created by artificial intelligence, AI, methods. The programming informed listeners about the experiment every 20 minutes. AI is taking your favorite radio by storm, a voice said. Our clones and AI are here to unsettle, surprise, and shake you. And for that matter, this text was also written by a robot. Recent AI developments have led to the creation of a series of tools that permit robots to lead different human activities. These tools belong to a group of systems known as generative AI. The tools use machine learning methods to train AI systems on huge amounts of data to produce human-quality results. One of the most highly publicized generative AI tools is called ChatGPT. It received wide attention by demonstrating the ability to quickly produce written answers to questions at a level and quality similar to humans. The development of generative AI systems has led to some criticism of the technology. Critics have warned that such systems, if used incorrectly, could cause economic, cultural, and social harms. The Swiss station's chief, Antoine Moulton, told the Associated Press that Couleur 3 was able to carry out the experiment because it is already known for doing provocative things. Moulton defended the project as a lesson on how to live with AI. I think if we become ostriches, we put our heads in the sand and say, "Mon Dieu, there's a new technology. We're all going to die." Then yeah, we're going to die because it, AI, is coming, whether we like it or not, Moulton said by phone. We want to master the technology so we can then put limits on it. Station officials said it took 3 months to train the AI to understand the needs of the station and learn the special requirements of its programming. Music that aired during the experiment was completely or mostly created by AI methods. Moulton claimed that was a world's first for a radio station. The experiment included human-sounding robot voices providing false short news stories meant to be too futuristic to be believed. These included a story about a temporary ban on spaceship flights over Geneva because of noise complaints. Another informed about the opening of the first underwater restaurant in Lake Zurich, while another told about visitors from outer space coming to Switzerland. Multon admitted there was a lot of discussion among employees about whether to go through with the experiment. He said he would have been willing to stop the project if his team was not fully supportive. The station said in a statement it received hundreds of messages on the day of the experiment, with some supporting and others opposing. One person complained of unfunny jokes. Another listener admitted to not recognizing the programming as an experiment. One critic called the project a waste of time for a station that gets public financing. Multon said about 90% of listener reactions suggested the experiment was a good idea. But many said they found the human element missing. Many listeners noted, "You can sense these are robots, and there are fewer surprises, less personality." Multon said some listeners were even more forceful, urging station officials to give us back our humans. I'm Brian Lynn.
There has long been a debate among experts about how best to teach children to read in the United States. The debate involves two methods for teaching words: learning words as a whole, or breaking down words into their basic sounds. Recently, however, many are starting to favor what they call the science of reading. The goal is to use methods that many years of research have shown to be effective to teach children to read. The science of reading is helpful for struggling readers, but schools and teacher training programs have been slow to use it. A push to teach all students in this way is gaining ground as schools look for ways to help students who fell behind in school during the pandemic.
The other method involved phonics. Phonics teaches how sounds work in combination to form words and parts of words. Supporters of this method argue that students need detailed lessons about the building blocks of language. That means spending lots of time learning letter sounds and ways to combine them into words. In 2000, a governmental group, the National Reading Panel, released findings of its research on methods for teaching children how to read. It said phonics was important, along with several related methods. However, what came to be used after this study was known as balanced literacy. It borrowed from both phonics and whole literacy methods. Its goal was to get children to read books they enjoyed as quickly as possible.
Michael Camille is a professor of education at Stanford University, who sat on the National Reading Panel. He said, "It wasn't a true compromise. The method often led to students learning how to guess words instead of how to say them correctly. Now, schools are putting more attention on phonics and other elements of the science of reading to help with poor reading performance. Makers of school books are adding more phonics and schools are ending some popular programs that lacked the method. The science of reading uses research from many fields that relate to how a child's brain learns to read. In practice, the method calls for schools to focus on the building blocks of words. Students no longer memorize word spellings. Instead, they learn the elements that make up a word. For example, with the word unhappy, students would learn how un changes the meaning of the base word happy.
For some children, television shows like Sesame Street and parents reading to them is enough. But 30 to 40% of children will need more teaching. That is part of the science of reading, says Timothy Shanahan. He is a professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Other children fall somewhere in between. They're going to learn to read, said Shanahan, who also was one of the members of the 2000 panel and former director of reading for Chicago Public Schools. They're just not going to read as well as they could be or should be. Colleges of education are often still teaching balanced literacy, even with concerns about its effectiveness. That means new teachers have little experience in using what are being called evidence-backed teaching methods. Shanahan said that means parents often have to help their children learn to read, paying for one-on-one teaching or workbooks. Extra help can be costly, and it adds to the lack of equality in education. As a result, some chapters of the NAACP, a civil rights group, are pushing for the science of reading to be used in schools. They say learning how to read is a civil rights issue.
Amelia Malone is a director at the National Center for Learning Disabilities in Washington. She said parents must read to their children. If not, she suggests helping teachers when they ask for it and pushing evidence-based methods in their children's schools. Parents can be part of the solution, she said. If we educate them on why this is kind of the movement we need. I'm Gregory Stockel.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
You just heard this week's Education Report, presented by Gregory Stockel and Anna Mateo. I have Anna here with me now to talk more about this story. Hi, Anna.
Hello, Ashley. Thanks for having me on the show.
So this week's education article is about teaching children to read and a debate on the best ways to do that.
That's right. There is a growing demand in American schools to go back to teaching phonics.
Can you explain for our listeners what phonics is?
Sure. Phonics instruction teaches the relationship between the letters of written language and the sounds of spoken language. So many literacy experts call phonics the building blocks of language. It is basically learning letter sounds and ways to combine them into words.
What kind of learner most benefits from phonics?
Well, there are several. Maybe a child lives in a home where English is not the first language, so they're not hearing English as often as their classmates. Or maybe a child doesn't have an adult who can read to them every day, as other kids have. Or maybe they have a learning challenge and they need a more direct and explicit breakdown of how words work.
I know you have a special interest in this topic.
I love talking about the science behind how we learn to read. In fact, we will soon be sharing on our website an early literacy series. It has articles and videos on the stages of reading, from print awareness to phonics to comprehension. In the articles and videos which I wrote, we give tips, learning strategies, and assessment or testing methods.
I'm sure that material will be super helpful for English beginners. Thanks again so much for joining me today, Anna.
You're welcome. I always love talking about reading methods.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. American military planners had to make an important decision when the United States entered the Second World War at the end of 1941. American forces could not fight effectively in Asia and Europe at the same time. The military planners decided to use most of their forces to defeat the German troops of Adolf Hitler. Only after victory over the Nazis was clear in Europe would they use all of America's strength to fight Japan in Asia and the Pacific. Because of this decision, Japan was able to win many of the early battles of the war in Asia. The fighting in the Pacific is the subject of our program this week. Japanese planes bombed the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii on December 7, 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
We take you now to Washington.
The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
The surprise raid marked the first of several major victories for the Japanese. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, Imperial forces attacked American bases in the Philippines. And within days, Japan captured the American island of Guam. Japanese troops landed in Thailand. They marched into Malaya, and they seized Hong Kong. The Japanese also moved into Indonesia and Burma. Even Hitler's troops in Europe had not moved so quickly or successfully. As one American historian wrote later, the Pacific Ocean looked like a Japanese lake. The United States began to fight back. General Jimmy Doolittle led a group of 16 American B-25 bombers that took off from the aircraft carrier Hornet and bombed Tokyo in a surprise raid.
The B-25 was selected because it was small, because it had the sufficient range to carry 2,000-pound bombs 2,000 miles, and because it took off and handled very well.
It was a bold move. The B-25 had never been launched from an aircraft carrier before, and the demands on the planes and the pilots were even greater with the weight of a full load of bombs. Japan's leaders believed no army could stop them. So they expanded their goals and launched new campaigns. That was Japan's mistake. It stretched its forces too thin and too quickly. The military leaders in Tokyo believed that the United States could not resist because American forces were busy fighting the war in Europe. But no country could extend its communications and fighting ability over such a great distance and continue to win. The turning point came in June 1942 in the Central Pacific with the Great Battle of Midway Island. Japanese Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto launched the battle. He wanted to meet and destroy the remaining ships in the American fleet before the United States could recover from the destruction at Pearl Harbor. Yamamoto had 162 ships. The American Admiral, Chester Nimitz, had just 76. But the United States had discovered how to read the secret messages of the Japanese forces. For this reason, Nimitz and the Americans knew exactly where the Japanese ships would sail, and they put their own ships in the best positions to stop them. The fighting between the two sides was fierce, but when it ended, the Americans had won a great victory. Admiral Yamamoto was forced to call off his attack and sail home. For the first time, the Japanese Navy had been defeated. The next big battle was at Guadalcanal, one of the Solomon Islands in the southwestern Pacific. Guadalcanal's beaches were wide and flat. Japanese officers decided to build a military air base there. The United States learned of the plans. American commanders decided that they had to prevent Japan from establishing that base. United States Marines quickly landed on the island. They were joined by troops from Australia and New Zealand. But Japanese ships launched a surprise attack and destroyed many of the American ships in the harbor. Allied forces on the island were left without naval support and suffered heavy losses. For 6 months, the two sides fought for control of the island. Historian and naval officer Samuel Elliott Morrison described the fighting this way in his book, The Struggle for Guadalcanal.
For us who were there, or whose friends were there, Guadalcanal is not a name but an emotion, recalling desperate fights in the air, various night naval battles, frantic work at supply or construction, savage fighting in the sodden jungle, nights broken by screaming bombs and deafening explosions of naval shells.
The fighting continued seemingly forever, but finally, in February 1943, the Japanese were forced to leave Guadalcanal. The battle was an important defeat for Japan. It opened the door for the American and other Allied forces to go on the attack after months of defensive fighting. But American military planners did not agree about the best way to launch such an attack. Admiral Nimitz of the Navy wanted to capture the small groups of Japanese-held islands in the Pacific, then seize Taiwan, and finally attack Japan itself. But General Douglas MacArthur of the Army thought it would be best to attack through New Guinea and the Philippines. The American leadership finally decided to launch both attacks at once. Nimitz and MacArthur both succeeded. Nimitz and his naval forces moved quickly through the Marianas and other islands. General MacArthur's troops attacked through New Guinea and into the Philippines. American ships defeated Japanese naval forces in the battle for Leyte Gulf. Throughout the Pacific and East Asia, the fighting continued. Many of the fiercest battles were fought on tiny Pacific islands. Japanese troops captured the islands early in the war, and they quickly built strong defenses to prevent the Allies from invading. Allied military leaders found a way to defeat the Japanese plan. They simply avoided the islands where the Japanese were strong and attacked other islands. But sometimes the Allies could not avoid a battle. They had to land on some islands to seize airfields for American planes. The names of these islands became well known. Tarawa in the Gilbert Islands, Truk in the Marshall Islands, Saipan in the Marianas, and other islands including Guam and Tinian. The two sides fought fiercely in the Battle of Iwo Jima. And on Okinawa, Japanese forces resisted for 83 days before finally being defeated by Allied troops. After the defeat at Okinawa, many Japanese understood that the war was lost, even if Japan had not yet surrendered. Emperor Hirohito appointed a new prime minister and ordered him to explore the possibilities of peace. But both sides still expected the Allies to launch a final invasion into Japan itself. And everyone knew that the cost in human life would be great for both sides. But the invasion never came. For years, American scientists had been developing a secret weapon, the atomic bomb. The code name was the Manhattan Project. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use it against Japan.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
American planes dropped one of the bombs on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And another on Nagasaki 3 days later. Exactly how many people in those two cities died from the force and heat of the blasts, or later from radiation, may never be known. The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. Japan surrendered on August 15, 1945, 6 days after the Nagasaki bombing. Suddenly, sooner than expected, World War II was over. More than 50 million civilians and soldiers died during the 6 years of fighting. Germany and Japan were defeated. The Soviet Union was strong in much of Eastern Europe, but the United States found itself the strongest military, economic, and political power in the world.
And that's our program for today.
Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.